You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hey, welcome to episode 50 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith, and I'm really excited to be at such a milestone. You know, dependent on our, our base 10 number system, sort of. But, you know, still, that means 25 weeks. Is that what that means? Wow. 25 weeks. That's like almost half a year. So I'd say 52 is maybe more of a milestone than 50 in some ways. That's hard to believe. I can't believe it's been that long, but, this is all coming crashing down on me right now. So episode 50. So on Monday we talked about free will and, we solved the problem. And, I was offered many interviews from, television stations around the world because I solved the problem of free will quite easily. No, it, I barely dipped into it. There's so much to say. I really don't know how much I have so much written down. And the problems, unfortunately, there's not a clear, I mentioned it, there's not a clear like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 logic of kind of the debate that I've been able to find between Sam Harris and Dan Dennett and in general, just free will in general. I'm really interested in what Dennett says outside of the debate. So I'm going to talk about that, but I'm not exactly sure how to, you know, structure it. So I'm just going to go, we'll see how it goes. I think either way, it'll be fine. You guys are all smart. You'll keep it organized in your brains. So, where we left off, we had Harris talking about things occurring, your subconscious, or your unconscious mind. I don't know what the real difference is there. It's probably some psychological term, but, one or the other thing, background processes are helping you make decisions. They are, you don't have control over them. You don't know what they're saying. You don't know what they're deciding until it's sort of decided. You can't really, and it's completely incoherent to even think of needing to think of your thoughts before you think of them. That doesn't even make any sense on Harris's view. And I mentioned Dan Dennett does reply. His answer to this would be that, as I said, the analogy of hockey or tennis or, you know, you do have control over them, maybe just not at the time, but you can build them up. You can, you know, these are things you can do. You can prepare yourself so that later on your unconscious processes will yield different results. And so I left off there sort of, and my reply to that, and I think it's roughly what Sam Harris says too, and you know, I'm sure it all occurs to you, is it just sounds like an infinite regress to me. So we're able, you know, Dennett would say, oh, okay, well, you know, you decide ahead of time to return the serve a certain way. You practice a bunch of backhand, forehand serves. I can just as easily ask, well, how did you make that decision? What led you to, making the decision to practice that? And we could trace it back to some processes that happen in the background that you're not aware of, et cetera. And Dennett, you know, you could continue this. Dennett would say, well, you had control of those at some point. And Dennett does say that infants don't have free will, and it's something that we earn and something that we, you know, not everyone has. Some people don't have it. Apparently, if they're morally incapable of, you know, if they're psychopaths or something, I mean, if they're not equipped in certain ways, they don't have it. So it's not something that's just gifted to us. We have to earn it somehow gradually. And I think this is an interesting view. And I want to say now that I'm going to talk later about sort of defining free will more because that really is a big problem. But right now, I don't fully understand how this works. So And Harris mentions this in his reply to Dennett. He says, well, whenever that first happened, you know, when an infant was, or a toddler, whenever it first is, whenever you pick, that amount of freedom that they somehow gain by taking control, you know, and reacting to, you know, their supposedly determined unconscious processes, the minute this freedom, as Dennett is defining it, arises, it arises because of some other determined process. So I don't fully see how that escapes the problem. And Dennett, I can't find where this is. I think it's in Intuition Pumps, which I loved. He says, and he said it in a talk too. That's why I said I can't find it. But I think there was another talk where I've heard it, but I wasn't seeing it in the YouTube, and they're very long. So I wasn't able to go back through all the talks, which I've watched countless times. I absolutely love watching Dennett's talks. So, but in, I know for sure it's in Intuition Pumps. He mentions an analogy to species, like mammals. The definition of a mammal is essentially having two parents that were mammals, and they reproduce and they form a mammal. Like that's essentially a basic definition of mammals, for the sake of this argument, you know, being able to, you're a certain species if your offspring is that same species, and, you know, vice versa. And he says, well, by that logic, if you take it back to infinity, there are no mammals, because for every mammal, they would have had to have mammal parents. And if you start at, you know, I don't know, some bacteria, which is clearly not a mammal, or you start way back when, before mammals, and you apply that logic, there are no mammals. And this he brings up as an analogy to the freedom thing that I mentioned, to the sort of solves the infinite regress. I liked this at first. I thought it was great. And it made sense. But the more I think about it, the more it just doesn't make sense. Because with mammals and evolution, it's pretty easy to grasp how this might happen. I mean, we can understand that change is gradual, and we can see that offspring is often pretty significantly different from their parents. I mean, we could see this. We know all the evidence. It's very easy to imagine how that happens. And it's easy to say that it's just a limit of our definition of mammals. It's not so easy to just cleanly define things. And that makes sense. It's just like the, you know, quandary of a pile of sand. You know, what exactly constitutes a pile of sand? If 1 grain of sand, no, that's clearly not a pile. 100 grains of sand, you know, somewhere in there, there's a pile of sand. And it's just because definitions are imprecise in this way. And it's, you can't really identify where it is, but some, you know, some average place there becomes, you know, between 1 grain of sand and 1,000,000, eventually you have a pile. For any given picture, you may identify it one way or another. So that I understand, it's a limit of language, and I can grasp how mammals would fall into that. You know, it as they change gradually, they stress our definition. And they challenge it, and it makes it kind of not work. I get that. I don't think the same can be said for this free will thing, because for every given decision and for every given point at which Dennett alleges that freedom could come and slowly accumulate, I can't think of how that mechanism works. Please let me know if you have a good idea for it, but it's like, somehow slowly as a, you know, infant to toddler to adulthood, you gain more freedom by, you know, loading up these, thoughts that are going to later pop up as Harris has illustrated with his example of choosing a city. Somehow that adds and gets you freedom, to a certain extent. I still don't understand the mechanism there. Because as Harris says, at the moment it does emerge, that freedom, it emerges in an exactly predetermined amount based on physics and the laws and your upbringing and all that. Like, it still is coming out at that exact same amount. So it's, I think that analogy doesn't quite work. But as we'll see later, the statement may still be true based on sort of a different definition of free will. But let me give an analogy to that problem I just mentioned real quick. One thing I thought of, this may be an imperfect analogy, but it's like if we had some number we're not sure about. Okay, we're starting with a number, we don't know what it is. We know it's a very big, big, big number. And we also know that the way we got to that number was to just add 2 every time. And we know that we started with 0. And to me, it's almost like Dennett is looking at this huge number that we just can't tell what it is. We have a guess. It's in a range of some amount, you know, and he's saying, well, this is an odd number. And it's even though despite the fact that we know where we start from and we know that we add two to zero every time to eventually get to some huge number, which seems to me to it has to still be even. But it's almost like Dennett says somewhere along the line, I know this is obviously, I'm not meaning to straw man him, but that's what I'm thinking of. Like that's how this problem, this solution fails to me. It's like, you know, every ingredient to this big number. I mean, it seems to all follow very strict rules, but somehow along the line of a certain number of years, he's saying it turns odd somehow. And that's, again, I'm not meaning to directly strawman his argument. I know obviously he would find that analogy ridiculous, or he would find that conclusion ridiculous. But that's what the problem is like to me. It's like somewhere he's getting an odd number out of that. Please correct me if you can figure out where that is, where the freedom comes from with all these predetermined things. Because like how do you quantify that? How much freedom is it? Why isn't it? You know, why isn't it all freedom? Why is it some tiny amount of freedom and then it adds up to more freedom? And does it stop? Do we just keep getting more free, or do we lose it? How is it that we build this? I mean, I guess we do. Maybe if our minds go bad, we do build it. I mean, when you start to try to quantify it, it seems weird. It's like, well, yeah, how much freedom is it? What determines how much freedom that is? It just doesn't quite make sense to me. But again, it may be that our definition of free will is the problem. So I'll give more about that later or now. I'm not sure. Let's see. Now, I think now I want to talk about what Harris identified as the main difference, and I think he's right. And I wish Dennett had responded to Harris's response, because first, let me digress a little bit. When I read this, I immediately gobbled these up as soon as they came out. And let me assure you, I don't know why I need to do this, why I feel the need to do this. I love both these guys. Like, I'm a huge fan of both of them. I really am. So it's not like I have, you know, like one over the other, and I'm trying to be closed-minded toward one. I went back and forth so many different ways. Not just with, oh, when Harris responded, I agreed with him, and then Dennett responded, I agreed with him. More, it was more like, you know, the weeks would go by. There was maybe months between responses. After reading one, I would think about it a lot. I'd think of maybe problems I had, and then a response would come out, and I usually my first reaction is to agree with it because they're such good writers. They're really good at almost rhetorical stuff. And unfortunately, after reading back and forth and thinking about it a lot, I'm a little disappointed with Dennett's first response. And if you read, I'll link all this if you haven't already read it. It's very fascinating. If you read, there is a problem that I identified in it that is not a huge deal, but was a misunderstanding that it made me worry about Dennett's response. And that was right here. He says, there's also another problem with this paragraph. The sentence about indeterminism is false. And he quotes Harris and he says, and to the extent that the law of cause and effect is subject to indeterminism, quantum or otherwise, we can take no credit for what happens, end quote. And then it goes on to describe this little thought experiment that is interesting. I'll briefly describe it because I do find it interesting. It doesn't matter how you set it up, but for some reason, someone needs to answer some questions, and he either has to hit a button for yes, a button for no, or a foot pedal for yes, a foot pedal for no. It's either or based on some display that's going to tell him which one to do. And so it asks him a question and says, use the foot pedals. And then it asks him a question and says, use the buttons, and he can answer this. And essentially, the point of it is that Laplace's demon can't predict what's going to happen because the mechanism deciding whether it's going to be the pedals or the buttons is indeterminate. There's no way for Laplace's demon to predict it. It's somehow quantum or otherwise. It's somehow just completely random, can't be determined. However, the guy still can answer the questions because he, and so Dennett brings this up and said that there may be some way in which our brain is doing this. If there are quantum quantum indeterminacies, our brain could be correcting for them and sort of filtering them out via this, you know, mechanisms like these. I'm not sure if there's any evidence for that, and it seems that would seem incredibly difficult to evolve, but it's possible to me. I mean, to my mind, that sounds very hard to imagine that that's true, but it's possible, and it is an interesting illustration. The problem is, when I read it, I mean, I don't think it addresses what Sam Harris was saying at all. He was just saying what I said in the beginning of this, Monday's episode, that if there is indeterminism, our free will can't live there. It's not like we wouldn't have free will under determinism, but because some, you know, screen can randomly tell us foot pedals or buttons, that gives us free will. Like, it lives in the indeterminism. And that's just the basic outlining of the problem of free will. I mean, that's in the very first writings about free will. I mean, this problem is introduced, and Dennett, he misinterpreted it, and it that's what made me nervous a little bit, because there are other things that I think he misinterprets a little, and it was interesting. I don't know how it made me feel. Just on a more personal level, I was reading it, and I worried me a little bit. Not to say that Harris never misinterprets Dennett. I mean, I found Harris's response to Dennett pretty appropriate, because Dennett wrote his response to Harris in, to my mind, it was very belittling. I don't know if Dennett intended it to be that way, if he consciously was trying to do it, or if it's just sort of the way, because he is quote unquote the expert on compatibilism, and Harris, maybe he sees Harris as not having sufficient credentials or something. I mean, I would argue that they both have sufficient credentials and could definitely argue about it, because there are plenty of people on either side who take the other's view. So it's not like, you know, Harris is going against the grain. He's maybe going against the grain of a majority of philosophers, but there are plenty of other scientists and plenty of philosophers who don't buy into compatibilism. So it's not just a question of degrees or schooling necessarily. It's, we better look at the argument. So I was a bit turned off by Dennett's tone, to be honest with you, in light of the fact that there was an obvious mistake right there that I just read. If Dennett had written a perfect essay that expertly interpreted everything Harris wrote and pointed out why it was wrong, there would be no problem. There would be no problem at all. I can understand having an impatient tone if Harris is completely wrong and he's out of his league and et cetera, and he criticized Dennett too much. But that's not the case. I mean, this is a very difficult subject. Even if, and I've read both sides a ton, it doesn't seem like a knockdown on either side. And, I'm not them. I'm not some genius or something, but I'm a pretty intelligent guy. And I would say that if, being decently well-read, as I'm sure you guys are too, if you're decently well-read and you read these and you're intelligent and you can interpret them, and it doesn't seem to be knocked down for either side, then I would say, while I'm not saying that Dennett's wrong necessarily, I would say he should be a little more accepting of the opposite position, I think. I was a little turned off by that. So that's just on a personal note. Let me know what you think about that. But now I would like to talk about Dennett's example that you may have seen in some videos and talks and stuff of the chess-playing computers. This is a pretty difficult one to follow along with, and I wouldn't blame anyone who didn't understand it at first. I certainly didn't. It took a few passes to really get what he was saying. But I'll try to... He takes a long time. It takes him like an hour to explain this, so I'm going to try to sum it up. I apologize, because I'm not going to take an hour, so I apologize if this is insufficient. But it has to do with the idea I mentioned earlier, probably on Monday, of what it means to have been able to do otherwise. He mentions Austin's missed putt. This is, I'll briefly read this. Consider the case where, this is by Austin, whoever this is, Jane Austen, no. Consider the case where I miss a very short putt and I kick myself because I could have holed it. It's not that I should have holed it if I tried. I did try and I missed. It's not that I should have holed it if conditions had been different. That might, of course, be so, but I am talking about conditions as they precisely were and asserting that I could have holed it. There's the rub. Nor does I can hole it this time mean I shall hole it this time if I try or if anything else, for I may try and miss and yet not be convinced that I could not have done it. Indeed, further experiments may confirm my belief that I could have done it that time, although I did not. And Dennett's, he says this a lot. He really harps on Austin because he says, I consider Austin's mistake to be the central core of the ongoing confusion about free will. If you look at the large and intricate philosophical literature about incompatibilism, you'll see that just about everyone assumes without argument that it is not a mistake. And the mistake, it's interesting. The mistake, I don't know how I feel about this. I thought it made sense at the time. I'm not sure it makes sense now. Maybe it does because he says the mistake is that further experiments may confirm my belief that I could have done it that time. Dennett has a huge problem with this. He says there's no experiments that could help you with that because, you know, what happened at the time happened. I mean, it was determined. You could not have made the putt in those exact circumstances. I would say that I think Dennett is making a little too much out of the wording here because he's saying it's confirming his belief that he could have done it that time, although he did not. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I would have to read the original literature to know what exactly he was trying to say with that, because I don't view it as so much of a mistake as Dennett does. But then again, Dennett's a genius, so I'm probably wrong. But anyway, the point of this is that Dennett's view is that rewinding the tape never tells us anything. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So I've mentioned that it means could have done otherwise. Now, when we talk about free will, the key difference between Harris and Dennett, between, you know, I can stop using them, it doesn't matter, between hard determinism and compatibilism seems to be this. It seems to be whether or not free will means could have done otherwise in those exact circumstances or could have done otherwise in circumstances very similar to those exact circumstances. Because Dennett says, and it took me a while to grasp this, but that if we just replay it, yes, you couldn't have done otherwise. If you just replay the tape, you don't learn anything. But there's a difference. There can be a difference between that and you can learn something about someone's ability based on how you might perform in similar circumstances. So the huge example he brings up is two chess-playing computers, program A, program B. They're, you know, program A has more processing. It's able to look deeper into things. Program B can't, but, you know, and then they're both on a random number generator to help them make certain decisions as far as, like, how long to look at each move and stuff. Because otherwise, if they ran the programs 1,000 times, they play the same game 1,000 times. That's not very interesting. So, likely program A would win if, you know, unless maybe he's playing black or something and they, you know, maybe it's a draw. But anyway, assuming they play a bunch of different games, they both have a random number generator, or pseudo random or whatever. And they both play different sides and all that. You can learn things, based on looking at times where they both were in the same position, but on opposite sides and did a different move. That tells you things. And so what he, and this is very hard to explain in limited time. So I'm hoping this, I'm doing a sufficient job, but basically what Dennett says is when we go to one of these spots where maybe A castled, but B didn't, what does it mean to say that B could have castled? Because if you replay it, it'll be exactly the same. It's deterministic. You know, the number generator, random number generator is random, but it's, you know, it's going to be the same random numbers every time you rerun the program. So in one sense, he couldn't have castled, but in another sense, he could have, if I say he for the program, I don't know why the program could have castled. If, the random number had been different, like maybe it pulled up a 9 instead of a 50 or something. I don't know how these things work, but, what he's saying is, even though if you replay the tape, you don't learn anything. He would do the same thing over and over in that situation. He could have had things been slightly different. The number could have told him to look one move deeper. And maybe if he looked one move deeper, the program would have seen that castling is the right move. So that example shows that we can't just look at replaying the tape. And there's another, honestly, I don't know if that example is all that necessary because it really takes him a long time to set up. It's fascinating. So maybe it is. Maybe there's something else that he gets out of it that that I'm forgetting. But it may be a simpler example is just a car. They bring this up in their debate a lot. You know, my car is going 40 miles an hour because I have my foot on the gas at a certain, you know, time. A certain weight, you know, a certain force. I'm applying a certain force to my gas pedal. If we replay the tape, that car will go 40 miles an hour every time. Could it go 80 miles an hour? Well, it could if there's different amounts of pressure being applied to the gas pedal, but not in those same exact circumstances. Dennett would say, Harris agrees with this, there's a difference between a car where the gas pedal is just stuck at 40, like it cannot be moved. There's a governor on it. It has to go 40. And a gas pedal where that's just being pushed at 40. The difference has to do with how they might perform in slightly different circumstances. So that's what Dennett sees as very important. One car could go faster or slower. The other car cannot because of whatever restrictions it has. And Dennett sees this as an important difference. And he sees it as sort of, you know, a way that we can have abilities that differ within determinism that still give us some sort of responsibility. So this seems to be the key difference. And Harris says, I think Harris did a great job of identifying the key difference in his second response to Dennett, or his first response to, I don't know. Anyway, his response to Dennett's response, because he zeroed in on this, and he identified, rather than go through all the individual errors that he thought Dennett was making, I really like how he handled this, and it makes sense. So in thinking about this, this is where I think we need to talk about the definition of free will, because if free will is defined as some sort of moral ability to learn and change your actions in the future based on, based on what happens and being responsible, if it's just moral responsibility, then I think Dennett is right. The question is whether or not we find that satisfying. Because as Harris says, and as anyone could say, Austin will miss his putt every time that's replayed. I mean, there's some condition necessary was absent for him to make that putt. So what's interesting to me, and what at first I agreed with Dennett, I thought this was great. I thought this was like a great example. And I thought that makes sense. It's moral responsibility. That's what makes the difference between us. And I think that's true. But what's weird to me is that it seems to be entirely dependent on the future. Because, okay, so I'm going to branch out on my own a little bit. This is not anything I've read. I'm just trying to think about this. I was trying to come up with little thought experiments or, you know, little, as Dennett might call them, intuition pumps to sort of identify the differences between these two views. Because here's the first thing I thought. If someone doesn't have memory, someone doesn't have the ability to create memories or suddenly loses the ability to create memories, do they lose their free will? And I think that you'd have to say yes, because if you're just doomed to repeat the same mistake, let's say you have a very simple choice, and if you choose wrong, you have to repeat the choice. And if you choose right, you don't. You can get out of it. But for some reason, and of course I could fashion this a little better if I wanted, but I'm just thinking in generalities here. For some reason, it appears to you as though you should choose the wrong choice. And this can happen all the time. I mean, we think we're making the right choice. We're not. We don't have some information or whatever. A person without the ability to make memory would simply choose, say his memory resets, it's sort of like memento. He would choose the wrong thing every time. He would continue to choose the wrong thing. He would deliberate on it. He would not have the piece of information where he remembers what went wrong. And so he would choose the wrong thing every time. It's weird to think that he could be free. So you'd want to say that he doesn't have free will. But the interesting thing to me is, compare that with someone who's exactly the same in every way, except they don't lose their memory after the first choice, like the other guy does. Say they are identical people, except after the choice is made, after the deliberation, after all that, there's a time where one guy's memory gets reset, or at least just that, you know, the relevant memories that would help him answer the choice, and the others doesn't. All the way up until that decision, and making that decision and pushing the button, the two people are the exact same person. There's no difference in them. Yet one, you'd say, does have free will, because when he pushes the wrong button, he's going to remember that button push and go, oh, okay, that was wrong. Maybe he'll reflect. He'll use the information to think a little longer or something, and he'll be able to get out of this infinite loop. But the curious thing is, up before that decision, during that decision, all the way until that guy's memory is reset, that, you know, person A is the reset memory guy, person B is not, they're identical. All the way until that time of reset, they're exactly the same. You could not tell who is who, because everything's exactly the same, except one guy is going to have his memory reset after the decision. So it's weird, at any time before time R of reset, I like making variables and stuff. Yeah, it's my thought experiment. I get to do whatever I want. All the way up until that time during the decision, you would not be able to determine which is which. So to say one has free will and one doesn't is very curious. This is just a thought experiment I thought of. There could be flaws in it. I encourage people to pick it apart. But that's interesting to me, and I thought of it because I was trying to emphasize the fact that free will seems to be dependent on changing behavior in the future, because Dennett's already given up on replaying the tape. He says, you replay it a million times, it's going to be the tape, and he's right. But I think this, my example, perhaps brings to light that there's something more we are wanting out of free will than simply the ability to make a different decision in the future or to learn from things. Because as Harris says, if Austin keeps putting and putting, I mean, something, it'll tell us about his ability as a golfer. I mean, he might be a crappy golfer who will never make that putt, or will miss most of them, or will, you know, when we change conditions slightly. But it never tells us anything different about that putt. There was some necessary condition that wasn't there when he missed that first putt. So I have a lot of these thought experiments. That's one. And I find it kind of convincing. I know it's a little weird, but I don't think it's any weirder than Dennett's space pirate illustration of indeterminism. So I don't know. I find it interesting that at a time going into the decision, and even to right after the decision to push button A or button B, that you can't tell who's who. And one of them you would want to say has free will and the other you don't, but maybe the solution is to say they both do or they both don't. If they both do, I'd be really curious about that, I suppose. I mean, you could say they both do because they're both deliberating. They're making the exact same deliberations in terms of what button they're going to push. But one guy will always push the wrong choice. He will never be able to make the right choice because he can't make those new memories. So it's interesting that free will is dependent on, like, the future. It's not just the present. So I don't know. That's, again, pick that apart by all means. I wonder if it's any good. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's something obvious about it that's wrong. I find it interesting. But we'll go ahead and move on to another point here. Oh, just to mention briefly, I thought of another version to try to make the same point, and that was to say, what if there's one person has to make a decision? I keep these poor people, and they're dude bros. They're not demons. There's a dude bro has descended to Earth and is going to destroy all of reality. Like, everything just will end. The universe will end if this guy pushes the wrong button. And for whatever reason, let's say that this dude bro, he's malicious, he's bad, he kind of wants the world to end. So he sets it up so that the guy is likely going to be wrong and get the wrong information. So he's going to make the choice. I mean, if you were a little smarter, he might be able to make the right choice, but he's going to make the wrong choice. I mean, it's all determined. Even, you know, Dennett has agreed, it's determined, given the state of affairs right before he needs to make this choice. There's lots of buttons and levers and stuff and thought experiments. You ever notice that? Maybe we need to upgrade them. He's going to touch a tablet. He's going to open an app to either end the world. No. But anyway, I was trying to isolate the fact that the future plays a role in free will. It seems like free will is, and Sam Harris's point is, it's sort of like the ability to change in the future. But if I'm trying to use this thought experiment to cut off time, it'll just, he's going to make the wrong choice and it ends. In what sense is he free to make the other choice? Because we've already decided, and this isn't, I'm not cheating to say that I've decided he's going to make the wrong choice, because people make wrong choices all the time. Dennett, you know, like when the guy misses the putt. Dennett's not arguing that he can't miss the putt, even if he's a good putter. I mean, we could very well set it up so deterministically, if you replay it, this guy will make the wrong choice every time, and then time stops. It's over. And he only gets one shot of it at it, and it's like no other decision he's ever made. However, he's free to sit there and deliberate as long as he wants. And he's going to. He's gonna think about one, you know, button A or tablet A. he's gonna think about tablet B. He's gonna do his best. And it in every sense of the word, that's like a free choice. He gets to sit there and freely choose. But then he chooses wrong, the world ends. And it's determined. It was all determined based on physics and his mind and everything. And the reason I went with the other thought experiment is this one, it's maybe not as compelling, but it's weird to think about, you know, time ends. He just makes the wrong choice, time ends. It's weird to think like, oh, well, he could have picked the other one. It's like, well, in what sense could he have? Like, if he happened to be in an imaginary situation where things were different, like, what does that do for you? It doesn't do anything except insofar as it affects the future, which is the point I'm trying to make. It's really interesting to me how that is. And it makes me think that there's something more to free will than just that. So let's explore some definitional things here. So it seems as though Dennett, and the reason this is hard to organize is because Dennett doesn't directly say this, I don't think, but this is something he's said, and I'm going to relate it to now. So there's clearly a difference between morally competent people and otherwise. I mean, people who have a tumor pushing on the brain, telling them what to do, and people who don't. Well, okay, maybe that's not a great example. Maybe Harris would argue there's not a clear difference between those people, but there's a difference between someone with a gun to their head where someone's controlling them, telling them you need to go take out all your money from the ATM. And there's a difference between that and someone who just decides to go take out all their money from the ATM for some other reason. I mean, that they view as a good reason. Maybe they're changing banks. I don't know. There's a difference there. Now, there's a difference between a person and, you know, dominoes, just objects that just fall where determinism and the laws of physics have decided they're going to fall. There seems to be some difference to people. And I would grant that difference as well, that clearly seem to be different things. There's a difference between a calculator or a basic computer that can make some tiny little decision on something and a person. But Dennett emphasizes this. He talks about that, you know, that's where the freedoms are. I mean, we have the freedom to deliberate and avoid things. He talks about evitability is the opposite of inevitability. We're able to avoid things that we want to avoid. We can try to see, like, if a rock's coming at my head, you know, we can see it. We can, in a split second, our brain decides we don't want to get hit with a rock. And so we duck. And that's where the freedom is. Whereas a tree just standing there, you know, you throw a rock at it, it just gets hit by a rock. Maybe it doesn't care, but that's part of not having will and consciousness and all that. But so what I want to say is that difference, does that sufficiently capture free will? This is me again. I'm trying to evaluate this problem. Does that capture it? Because I don't know that it does. Because you could make a computer that was very complicated, and one would argue that we have. I mean, we have computers that make complicated decisions. And in a way, they are deliberating about it. I mean, this is going to get into a muddy debate about, you know, whether there's AI or whether computers can ever be conscious or et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, you can't deny that computers can go through, have processes and have other processes to a certain extent that we are able right now to be able to evaluate problems. They are deliberating. They are, you know, it's loading. It's making a decision. It's, to, you know, like in some ways they are. And so, but we wouldn't say that these computers had free will, really. So that's what if we give the computer the input of avoid rocks and it gets the input, you know, the basic programming, and we give the computer the sensory ability to see the rock, and we give it the physical ability to move from the rock. It has all those things. It has evitability, but does it have free will? And I don't think it does. So I would worry that though Dennett emphasizes the differences there, I don't know that that captures free will entirely. So it's hard to define it. And then another thought I had that, and again, apologies for the not entirely linear organization of this, but I'm thinking these are all pretty decent thoughts. I hope they are. I hope you find them interesting. If not, then just, you know, complain. But my, you know, I referenced when I was in college and I tried to write a paper on free will, and I was under no illusions, again, that I was going to solve it, even though I didn't know no illusions at the time. I wouldn't meet him online till many years later on a gay dating website podcasting. No, just joking. So I was under trying to think of a different word, no impression. I was not, and I even wrote the paper this way. I wrote, you know, of course I'm not going to solve the problem of free will. Otherwise it would have been solved a long time ago by someone far smarter than I am. But my angle of attack that I chose was, I think it was Hume. I meant to look this up and I forgot, but I'm already going. I don't think it matters too much who it is. It's Hume or somebody. Hume's always a good guess. Oh, I don't think it's Hume though. Somebody wrote about causality and the fact that it's not a priori knowledge, because if you imagine waking up, you're a completely new person in the world and you see like a billiard ball and it's going to hit another billiard ball, you're not going to be able to predict that with no background knowledge. You're not going to be able to predict the fact that the other ball will bounce and roll away. For all you know, they could explode. They could, you know, like some other thing could happen. And I remember reading this. It was really interesting papers and problems with causality. I mean, all we can do is identify correlations. We're really good at it, and we can, you know, we've identified so many that we get a good picture of what's going to happen most times, and we could predict things. But it's not really a priori knowledge. It's not something we would know without observing it. And so my attempt at free will at the time was, I also did another hypothetical, and this is a hypothetical that could cheat. I don't know that this is valid. And again, I wrote this in college, so I think I'm a little smarter now, but it's still interesting. My angle was theoretically, hypothetically, someone could become aware of every single factor leading into their decision. You could be aware of all of it. And you could argue that once you had this total awareness, there's nothing unknown or behind or forced about your decision. You're purely, you have all of the information and you are making a choice. And that was my argument to kind of go against the fact that, oh, this choice is based on this gene. This choice is based on, you know, this small sub choice, you know, meta choice and desires based on, you know, something that happened 10 years ago, blah, blah. If you could be aware of all of it, if you could somehow take everything into account, which I know would probably be impossible, which is why I'm not sure if this is a legitimate thought experiment. I'm not sure if it follows rules that you would need to follow. My argument was that you could then make that decision, and maybe in the same way as the causality is not a priori, it would almost be indeterminate in that whatever you would decide would end up sort of being the cause and effect. I mean, it wouldn't be determined in like you'd almost be deciding whether the billiard ball was going to explode or go to the Ryder, do something that we can't really conceive of because we've always witnessed billiard balls doing certain things. So that was my attempt at the time. The only reason I bring it up, I'm not sure, I'm not really convinced by it, but the reason I bring it up, because when I started thinking about that, it's like, well, okay, if you were aware of every decision, say you're making a decision whether or not to eat an apple or something, you're aware of everything that goes into that decision. Well, what are you going to do? I mean, you're still going to pick the best thing for you. If you've determined that there's no other food, perhaps, you know that you're not going to be able to find any other food before you'll starve to death, but you've determined that if you eat this apple, you will be able to survive just long enough to find plenty of more food. Well, you're going to eat that apple every single time. There's no additional freedom that knowing everything really gives you. I mean, it just gives you the ability to make the right decision. But hypothetically, that got me thinking, well, then you wouldn't, if you have all the information, you'd make the right decision every time. So in some ways, that makes you more predictable and more, in some ways, less free, right? I mean, you are free, but you would never make the decision. It's like saying you're free to not love God, but you're going to go to hell for eternity. It's like saying that. I mean, oh, okay, well, then I guess I'll have to love God. If I knew for sure that if I didn't love God, I was going to burn in hell forever. All right, I'll give it a try. Let me try to love God. So it's like that was what really started confusing me back in 2006, 2007. That's how long I've been thinking of this. Not terribly long compared to some of the older folk out there, but I've been thinking about this issue a long time. I love it. It's really fun. Doesn't mean I've necessarily solved it any further than any of you, but that's how long I've been thinking of it. For that whole time, I thought, well, what? It's not like in that way, free will and determinism cannot help but be compatible, because you would not want any free will that wasn't determined. You would not want the ability. No one would value the ability to have all the information and make the totally wrong decision that's going to end up killing you. I mean, you have a decision to either jump off a cliff or not, and you have all this information. And deterministically, it's going to say that an agent who wants to live is going to stay on that cliff every time and not jump off. You're going to make that decision to stay on every time if you have all the information. There's no reason why you'd ever choose otherwise, which is interesting. It's like we want free will, but we want that ability to make decisions based on things, which is just reeks of determinism. So it's the definition is really hard, which in turn is kind of what moves me toward Dennett's definition of moral responsibility. And now I'm going to talk about, gosh, I don't know. I'm looking at my notes here. I probably have more, but I'll go ahead and talk about what I think could be the final thought experiment of these episodes, because I'm already getting a little long. Okay. This was a thought experiment I thought of. When I thought of this, I thought I was 100% on board with Dennett. And maybe I am. I don't know. It's so hard. But anyway, here's this last one I have time for. I think of a lot of these. I hope they're interesting to you guys. We'll see. So I was thinking about it, and I think it's useful to think about computers as regards this, because historically we've thought we're so much more special than everything else. But as we get smarter and as computers get more advanced, it seems to be the case that, maybe one day we'll discover we're just very complex computers, and we can make computers that are sufficiently complex enough. I think Dennett believes that AI is possible, strong AI is possible. And I think I would agree with that. So I was thinking, what would it require? What would be required for a machine to be morally accountable? And so I was trying to think of that, about that question, because if free will is moral responsibility, if that's our definition, I'm just wondering what would be required of a machine to where I guess we would say they had free will, or we'd at least say they had moral responsibility. And I was thinking, if we look at that machine, whatever we arrive at here, and we compare it to us, is there something additionally that we have, something in addition that we have, or that the machine has, or something? So I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, okay, if someone had invented, how do we define what we'd hold morally accountable? And to me, it's something that we would punish. You know, like that, if you, there's a reason we don't punish rocks, you know, there's just no point, you know, but we do punish kids and we do punish adults who are bad, you know, and I'm thinking why that is. So if someone has invented, let's just imagine someone's invented like a machine or sort of like a set of code or something, somehow it creates a punishment for computers. I don't know if it's like a like they feel pain. And let's just assume it can be attached to any computer, even though I'm sure there obviously have to be tons of other, requirements, but for simplicity's sake, and I don't think it tampers, you know, I don't think it taints the, thought experiment, but let me know if you disagree, but we'll just assume it's like a sort of a feeling module that we can attach onto any machine, which, now that I think about it, I mean, maybe that's breaking the rules of the universe too much, but I don't think it'll matter. We'll see. So, and this, we have a button that can essentially punish a computer. It can give them, I don't know if it has to be pain. It just has to be like discomfort or some sort of, you know, shame. I don't know. Some feeling that we're agreeing is a punishment. So now I was thinking, under what circumstances would we ever find it morally acceptable to push this button that would cause a feeling of discomfort when a machine has like failed at something, it's done something wrong. Now, if we just thought about a calculator, you know, which a calculator, which you press 5 plus 10 and it gives you 14. Would there be any reason to push this button? Of course not. I mean, it's just broken. It's obviously there's something wrong with the programming or there's something wrong with the screen where it's actually solving it right, but it's displaying probably. I mean, it's so simple that it would make no sense to punish. It'd be like punishing a rock. But if you go up tons of levels of complexity, to my mind, it's as though if you had a really complex computer that was in charge of some sort of task that was important, and the computer, it would need to be able to learn. Otherwise, you're punishing something for no reason. I mean, if you have... Oh, first off, here's the first thing. If you have a creator of this computer who you can just talk to and it can just adjust some knobs and fix it, there's never any reason to punish it. And we'll come back to this later, but that has some interesting implications to me, to my mind, it does. But let's assume that this computer was designed partially through like guided naturalistic principles, maybe, or just for whatever reason, we can't just tinker with it. Like we can't just, oh, we'll fix this little problem that it has. You know, maybe the way it was designed, it's so complex that someone designed it to evolve. Like its programming somehow evolved and reproduced a zillion times and created an incredible like intelligence. We'll just assume something like that. So we would have to not have accesses to it. Like I said, if we had access to just changing, oh, let's fix this little knob, let's fix this little, you know, this circuit breaker here, some component of the robot, it would make no sense to push a punishment button. What would be the value of that? We just go to the source. However, if we didn't have that ability and it was this robot was making a decision that would negatively affect someone and it had the ability to learn, I would say it could be, it would make more sense than anything to push this button. If it's in charge of directing traffic and it directs a car into another car, and we've determined that this robot, there's no other way to fix it except to push this little punishment button, and it can learn. It can, when you push it, it doesn't like it. So it kind of examines its programming. It figures out, okay, clearly these cars, you know, it's not good if I make them run into each other. So I'm going to change, and it has to be able to change itself, of course. If it can't change, you would never in a million years push this button because it makes no sense unless you're just evil. So that I found this very interesting. I don't know if this is as interesting to you, but when I thought of that, I was like, wow, that makes sense because it is kind of analogous to where we are. I mean, but it's interesting when you think about God, because if the second there's a God that's in charge of everything that could just fix somebody and make them act appropriately, we'd be foolish to hold the person accountable. It would make no sense. You could only hold God accountable. But I suppose you could say if God, for for reasons that he finds, you know, sufficient, that I find mysterious, he's decided to completely exit our lives. I guess we have no choice but to push each other's little punishment buttons to try to get each other to act properly. So I find this interesting. So it seems clear that moral responsibility does exist, and it can be right to punish people to a certain extent, or almost maybe just to incentivize them to do certain things, because it's just a reality of what we need. I mean, we need our traffic directing robot to direct traffic properly or something like that. So regardless of your view on free will, I think it's clear that moral responsibility is useful and exists. But I still come back. I think when I thought of this experiment, I thought, oh, this is what Dennett means. I mean, he means free will as moral responsibility. It's the ability to change your mind, to learn, to make decisions. And that those abilities give you responsibility. And I agree with that. But I'm not entirely convinced that that's all we mean by free will. So that's kind of where I am. There's more I want to say. Oh God, it's already an hour. Okay. There's more I want to say on responsibility and stuff. So I may end up doing just a short part of whatever my next episode is. Or I don't know. We'll see. I'm also guessing I already, even just, you know, just having released Mondays, I already have a ton of comments because people love this topic. So I might want to just go over comments with people and stuff. So I'll leave it here. I hope I've given you guys some cool stuff to think about. I hope to hear from you. I'm not really interested in hearing from anyone who just thinks that there's, you know, one side of the argument is obviously wrong and idiotic and the other is right. Like, I'm just, yeah, not really interested in that. Because I think there's clearly some problems. I mean, I have no problem if you want to pick, if you guys all have a side of the argument, you want to argue for it. That's no problem whatsoever. But, I worry about seeing a tone of dismissiveness to either side. And then that doesn't interest me all that much. So just be aware of that if you're going to comment. All right. It's that time where I need to thank my patrons. You guys are the absolute best. I mentioned on Monday's episode, the new goals. Check them out. If you guys want a podcast that is a feed that is just no ads, no, none of this, I know maybe you guys want me to thank patrons on the feed, but I'm kind of thinking I shouldn't. I think thanking the patrons is for you non-patrons to hear. But we'll see. That's debatable. But anyway, I'm thinking it would be cool to make a feed that is totally free of any sort of ads, any sort of patrons, anything. It's just pure content because you've earned it by being a patron. So get me to that goal, guys, and I'll do it. I'll put in that extra work. So there you go. I hope you'll go to patreon.com/atheist and check that out. But in the meantime, I just want to thank my patrons here. We have the usual, my big donors here that I love so much. You guys just make me so happy. I can't even explain. Jonathan Moyer, Havard S, John P, Bangs Naughty Bits, thank you guys so much. And Jeff Pearson, Dale. Dale was on the last bonus content. Interesting discussion from a Buddhist atheist, so be sure to check that out. Cincy Farmer, Jeremy Sharp, Matt Garrett. Those are my top guys. Thank you so much, you guys. I appreciate it so much. I can't even tell you. I really do. It's just amazing. I this is a lot of work, but you guys make it all worth it. This in particular was a lot of work because there was a lot of thought and prep, and it was really hard to organize everything, but it's totally worth it. The topics I care about, and you donors you really just make it such a pleasure to put in all the time and effort into making what I hope is a good show. So thank you guys as usual. And man, I can't wait for the comments on this one. I'm curious to see what everyone says on the various points I made and if they find any of my thoughts interesting. So I will call it episode 50. It's the end. Halfway to the 100, which will be another milestone for arbitrary reasons. So there you go. Okay. I'll see you guys next week. Oh, this week, bonus content, Tracy Moody. I think she's coming on. We haven't done it yet, but we're slotted to. So she's always so much fun to talk to. So yet another of the many reasons to go to patreon.com/atheist. So do that. All right. See you guys next time.